Hey Tim, how you doing? Good to have you on again. And we had a fantastic previous session in the last podcast that we did. And in that, we really explored, what was happening with premiums, why they were going up, how insurance companies come up with this stuff. But during the course of that discussion, obviously you were giving away some tips on how people could look at, reducing insurance or try to get the best prices they could for their premiums. Now, I've got to be honest, we had a lot of comments on that video, and quite a lot of people felt that you hadn't been able to cover the whole, because at one point, I think you held up a paper and you said, I've got 10 points. And people felt that, we hadn't had the time to cover all of them. So in this episode, what I'd like to do is let's start by recapping some of the stuff that some of the tips, some of the key points that you'd mentioned earlier. And then let's launch into those ones that we didn't have time to cover last time. So over to you, Tim.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I want to just say about it as well is that so all the information today that I'm going to provide as tips and assistance as a guide to help you with how to obtain the best insurance quotes. That information is being provided by MultiClaim Guru as my company name rather than Tim Kelly or through Shad. So just if anybody's aware of it and they want to know where that information's come from. It's being done under that, so just a bit of a disclaimer there because there's some information in that that insurance companies might not be happy with me saying, but all the information being provided is factual, and I want to make sure that people out there are correctly informed and educated and understand the best way of obtaining a quote. So that's the start thing. But what I'll do is I've got 20 different things to go
Brilliant.
through.
Thanks for
So.
doing that. Yeah, it's good to make that absolutely clear. Thanks.
Yeah, no, and I say it's mainly to think that if anybody isn't happy, it's not Shad who's saying this information, and it's not Tim Kelly. It is MultiClaim Guru. Okay, I've got 20 different things that I'm going to run through, and probably
Oh, bring it on
counterintuitive.
then.
Yeah, and bring it on. It's so, and again, and just to let the people know as well. So the people who are actually commenting on the video as well, I really appreciate your comments. There's so many who were so kind
Yes.
and things that you were saying, complimentary about what I was doing. It's very flattering of you, and thank you very much for that. It's very much appreciated. I love helping people, and part of what I've done through MultiClaim Guru is that I dislike the way insurance companies treat people, and I want to make sure that customers get treated the best way and they get what they're entitled to. So counterintuitively, with getting the best quote you want, you actually want to look at what is the purpose of why you have an insurance policy. And what are you paying for? Now, I could quite easily say, right, here's a lot of tips of how to get the cheapest premium. Really, you don't want to be doing that. What you want to be doing is you need to be focusing on what is it you want from that premium, from that policy, because you want to buy the best thing that you can afford rather than the cheapest. Because if you go out and buy a policy at 150 quid and you think, great, I've just got a really cheap premium here. If it doesn't pay out in the event of loss, you've lost 150 quid. So if you spend £1,000 on a premium, but it's with a really good insurance company with a great customer service and the contract's really well written, then in the event of loss, if they pay everything that you've lost, it's the best contract you'll ever have, and it's worth the money that you spend on paying more money for a quality thing. So the first thing you need to do is what is it you want from that policy? So if you want the cheapest policy possible, going back 20 or 30 years ago to when we were kids, you might have just said, well, get a third party only policy or third party fire and theft, because generically they were the cheapest premiums that are out there. What's happened in the last 15 years is that the general marketplace has shifted to fully comp policies because insurance companies have worked out that people were more likely to claim a third party only policy or a third party fire and theft policy than what they would on a fully comp. So fully comp policies became cheaper. What's happened in the environment, well, in our global economy now, is that things got a bit tighter. Play around on price comparison websites and see. So if you've got, as a general rule of thumb, if you've got a policy on a low value car, you want to look at it on the basis that you're never going to claim ever. So you're not going to claim for your own vehicle. You're only going to claim the event when you've caused damage to somebody else's property. And that's when you need a third party liability policy, so third party fire and theft or third party only. So if you've got a low value vehicle that's not worth insuring, but you want to protect yourself against the risk against you, don't just necessarily go for a fully comp policy. Go on the price comparison websites and compare them, because In the past, they were always more expensive than a fully comp policy because insurance companies have tried to steer people away from it. But in the last year, because of costs going up, they started to change again. So you might well find that if you've got a car worth a grand or 2 grand, it might be better to go for a third-party fire theft and policy. So that's the first thing. In terms of who you're insuring through and going on the different means of accessing a premium, either using price comparison websites, working through brokers or direct insurers, when you get your quotes, don't necessarily go for the cheapest one again, like I said. So you actually want to work backwards from the end result. So the reason why you've got an insurance policy is in the event you're making a claim, you want to be able to benefit from that contract in some way. So you want to have it so the insurance company pays out. Do your research on the insurance company. So go on Trustpilot, go on Google reviews, money marketplace, stuff like that. Look at what feedback people are providing about that insurance contract or that insurance provider, because the last thing you want to do is insure yourself with somebody who's not so great. So before we started this phone, this YouTube that we're doing today, Chad said to me, don't mention any name. Don't say he's great. Don't say he's dumb. So I can't, because there is that concern about people coming to us. So we can't do it. You can. So just because somebody's cheap doesn't mean they're great. Just because somebody's expensive doesn't mean they're great. So do your own research. Go on the different Trustpilot or Google reviews or anybody else who does a review for it, and check out these insurance companies to make sure that they're a good insurance company. Once you find ones that are good, then there's different ways of looking at how best to get a policy or a premium. Things you need to be careful of as well are things like policy wordings. So a good example of this, I'm going to go through different tips of what is required of you when you're taking a policy out and the legislation that revolves around it. So I'm going to go with that. It's about 0.6 or 7 in my notes that I've got beside me. But things like market value of the vehicle. So as an example, you go out and buy a brand new vehicle. It's £30,000. You take out an insurance policy. The insurance company tells ask you the question, how much is the vehicle worth? You say it's worth £30,000. They then charge you a premium on the information you provided to them. The vehicle's insured. Every year that vehicle then devalues, but you'll find that the insurance company's quote probably won't change. Now, as the car gets to like 5 year old, 10 years old, the vehicle could then be worth £5,000 or £3,000. But because the vehicle's insured on its group rating, the value of the car has a little bearing on the premium you pay. So it's probably like 0.1%. So don't think you're being clever by saying my vehicle's only worth £2,000 or £3,000 when it's worth £15,000 or £20,000, because the effects on your premium will be virtually nothing. And also, just because you tell somebody that you think the vehicle's worth £20,000 when it's worth £15,000, you are not insuring the vehicle for that figure. So the policies in the general marketplace are for the market value of that vehicle at the point of loss. It isn't for what you're telling them. Now, the only bearing it has on the premium is that, and you'll never be able to determine what this is because the insurance companies change it from one to another, but within the actual way they underwrite the policy, there'll be limits. It could be, as an example, so I'm not saying specifically are these, it could be that it's from £0 to £5,000, from £5,000 to £15,000, from £15 to £30, from £30 to £50, from £50 to £100. Each one of them might make a slight incremental increase on a premium, because the higher the value of something is, the more risk there is to an insurance company. But again, the effects are negligible. So the bit that I'm going to get into now is more through the legislation side of it, or what duties you have to an insurance company. And there's two different ones. One's as a consumer, one is as a commercial aspect, as a business, if you're a small business. So the key thing I want all of you to know is be as truthful as you can. Don't lie. Don't deceive. Don't think you're being clever. Always be as truthful as what you can to an insurance company. The reason being is that you never want to afford to an insurance company any opportunity in any way you can ever think of for them not to pay out on the policy. So always be truthful. So the pieces of legislation that apply to a consumer we have something called the 2012 Consumer Disclosure and Representations Act. Now, previous to this, and this links into the next piece of law, so we have, this shows you how long it takes insurance as an industry to change. So the original part of legislation that applies to insurance is called the 1906 Marine Act. So the first revision in insurance law from 1906 was the 2012 Consumer Disclosure Representations Act, and a secondary one, which was called the 2015 Insurance Act. It literally took over 100 years before anything changed with insurance. It's quite a slow industry to affect change. So the reason why this is significant is that in the past, the way it was seen was that an insurance company might not ask you the right questions to ascertain risk. So as a result of that, it could give them a carte blanche to actually not pay out in the event of a policy, or to actually say you're carrying, doing something fraudulent. And it was seen through Parliament that there's a potential risk to consumers and they need to be protected from that. So in this 2012 Consumer Disclosure and Representations Act, which we'll call CEDRA, because it's a lot shorter than, say, in the longer version, it specifically changed the wording within the legislation of how an insurance company should treat you. And the difference is being is that as a consumer, this is why it's CEDRA and not this 2015 Insurance Act, when an insurance company asks you something, or whether it's on a price comparison website, the specific legislation says, when asked, you have to provide that information. So you don't need to offer that information to you, but to them. But when they ask you a question, when asked, you need to be accurate and truthful in that information. So don't mislead them or tell them, or, you know, so for example, it could be you've got points on your license. If they ask you, you've got any points on your license, you need to declare that to them. You can't mislead them. If you do mislead them, it gives them the opportunity not to pay out on a claim in the event that you do. The other piece of legislation, which doesn't relate to consumers, so if you are a commercial entity and you're a business, it comes under something called the 2015 Insurance Act. And where this legislation changes is it doesn't come under the premise of when asked. It comes under the premise of you need to tell a prudent insurance company anything that they potentially need to be aware of. So as a consumer, you don't need to offer information. As a small business or as a business, you do. So you will find that if you're a business owner and you might have company cars on the policy, it's best dealing with a broker, and the broker should ask you all the relevant information that they think that they might need to be able to go to an insurance company to get the right type of policy for you. But also you need to tell them everything. So even things you might not think is being related to what you're doing, you still need to make it. It could be, you know, you might have had a counter-court judgment against your company, as an example. They'll see that as something that is a bearing that has an effect on whether they think you're liable as a risk. It could be you're done for fraud. It might be that you employ people who in the past might have served time in prison. So even though there's aspects of legislation that will cover them further under the Rehabilitations Act, it's still something a prudent insurance company might not, you know, they might need to be aware of. So there's a difference between being a member of the public and a small business.
So can I just ask, I think people might be wondering this, is like when you say, if they ask you a question, tell them that information or they won't pay out, that presumes that they've found out something that you haven't told them. How do they find out? Is there a database? Is your information out there? Is there something that they refer to?
Yes, it's a short version. So what you've got is that the main database used by insurance companies is called the Chief Underwriting Exchange, so it's called Q. What you have on Q is all the information relating to you. So if you want to know what information the insurance industry hold about yourself, then if you Google MID, so Motor Insurance Database, so you can do Ask MID, that's also run by the Motor Insurance Bureau. So the MID and the MIB are the same thing in essence. And what you can do with that is if you have an accident that's not your fault, as an example, and you want to find out whether the vehicle is insured, you can go on the MIB and the MID and find out the insurance details for that vehicle. If you want to find out who the owner of is on the insurance company that it's insured through, you can do a one-time request to find that information out. What you can also do is you can actually do the same thing for yourself. So if you've, and this is quite easily done in the days of doing everything online, if you forgot who you've insured yourself through and you're thinking like, you know, I did it as a price comparison website, it diverted me through from one company to another one. I know I went through X price comparison website, but I don't know who the actual insurance company is. You can go on Ask MID and it uses the data from the chief underwriting exchange to tell you. Now, what you can also do is, if there is anything that you think you're being penalised for and you don't know, so you might think there must be something to do with adverse claims history or something like that, that insurance companies are factoring into the premium that I'm not aware of, you can use it to tell you. So in essence, you're doing something which is called a subject access data request. It's a SARS request. But you can request all the information about everything personally relating to you, what policies you've got. If you've got people on your policy, you can't specifically ask their personal information, but if it's linked to your information, you can. So what should happen is that when you go through the process of obtaining a premium and you're being asked specific questions, that information goes onto the database, and it then means that any insurance company wanting to check it could find out. So have you got no claims? And if you do, how many no claims have you got? There's interesting things that relate to your policy later on that I'm going to go through as well, which insurance companies won't be happy about, but I'm going to tell you potentially ways of using no claims to your benefit. And that's not actually on one policy, it could potentially be on two, but insurance companies don't want you to know this because they'll say you can't. But yeah, all your information should be on there. Now, what you've also got as well is you have the motor insurance anti-theft register. So it's MyAfter. So when you do a HPI check on a vehicle, you want to check it whether it's been a previous total loss or not, then the vehicle will be registered on MyAfter to record that history. What you don't know is that MyAfter doesn't just record details about vehicles, it also records details about people. So you can do because they have to be registered through the Information Commissioner's Office. So I, for example, as a business, because I hold people's data, I'm registered with the ICO, so if anybody wanted to access their information about them when they come through to me, I would have to keep that for 6 years. MyAfter, you can do the same thing with them. So if there's anything potentially where you think you're being penalised in some way and you don't know what it is, then you can request, because they're registered with the ICO, any information about you personally. So whether it's to do with criminal activity, whether it's to do with fraud and theft concerns, if there's something that's on there potentially that could affect you, find out on there. But Q is your main one, MID.
Cool.
Okay. Now, the thing is, there's also I can't remember what it's called now because it's been ages since I've used them. There's also a private limited company that facilitates insurance companies in fighting cases where there is potential fraud. And they share information between themselves, but because it's a private limited company, trying to access that information is different because you've not contracted with them differently. You've not contracted with them directly. And this company, which I can't remember the name of, it's virtually impossible to take your information out of their hands because they just see it as being a potential fraud risk. So there's people out there who are being penalised, probably unlawfully, and you can't get that information took off. It's just because somebody somewhere thought, I don't like Shad, he's up to something, I'll contact this company, can you do some research on me? And you can't get it off. Right. It's a nightmare. So I can't remember who it is now, and I can't jump out of my browser to have a quick shot.
That's right. We'll put it in the comments or the description later on. Yeah. On issue.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back into it.
So, yeah. So your next one then is, like I said, so I've gone through CEDRA, which is really important. So on my list, you can see there, to highlight it, never lie. Yeah. So never mislead an insurance company, never lie. So there is a certain economy of truth in terms of how you phrase things. What I would also say is that bear in mind that the people that you're speaking to, if you're on a phone, there is artificial intelligence that works in the background that analyzes your voice when you're speaking to them.
No way.
So, yeah, yeah. So that's part of what I do is I help in. Yeah, yeah, of course it does. Yeah. So now we can do voice recognition, and we can monitor the patterns and the tones, the intonation, the things that you're saying, and work out whether you're being truthful or not.
So wow.
If that doing that,
are all insurance companies using this now?
Pretty most of them, yeah. I'd say, don't know, ooh, not all of them, but most of them.
Wow.
I'll give myself an out with that one.
Okay.
So, yeah, don't be clever, because they'll pick it up. In the event you're making a claim.
Is this when you're first asking for a quote, or is this when you're making a claim, or both?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely, both.
Ah.
Absolutely. So, what I would say is, either in the event that you're speaking to somebody on a phone taking out a premium, or you're making a claim, before you ring them, make notes, write things down, so you're clear and concise in what you've got. So if there's an example, you have got points in your license, or you have made a claim in the past, the duty lies on you as a consumer to answer when asked accurately and not mislead the information, mislead the insurer. So don't ever give an insurance company the opportunity to not pay out on a policy. So make sure you've got all your facts clear and concise before you contact them. So write down everything before you speak to them. And then that way, you know, you've not made, it could even be an innocent error. And there is things in within that you can, you know, the world take that into consideration. But write it down. And then that way you're not going to cock up. But also, like I said, it's they do monitor the way you speak. And I've dealt a lot with it in the past. I'm going to be careful with something that I say, because there's things where it benefits insurance companies, the consumers not knowing it, because they want to catch fraud. So I don't want to let people who are carrying out fraud get away with it, because that's wrong. And the more people who do that, it affects everybody's premiums. Yeah. So they go up, the more fraud that's there. So there's some things I don't want to say, but make sure you got all your information ready before you do.
Cool.
So let's
move on, because I think we've made that abundantly clear now. But let's move on. Listen, did we quickly recap some of the things that you covered before?
We've not. So part of the recap we gave was in terms of
sentences. Let's just recap so that in case people haven't had a chance to see the previous video as well.
Yeah. So just as a general recap on it, the way insurance companies work isn't the way you think it works, because they use your premiums to invest in other stuff, and that's how they offset and reduce policies, make them cheaper. So the reason why premiums are going up is because they haven't got the investment returns, and that's the reason why they're going up this year. And also it's like the cost of living and everything else that's affecting them. So what you're seeing in your premium isn't a one-off thing. It's just something that's affecting everybody at the moment. So that's the first part of it. The second side of it then is that when taking out a policy, there's a sweet spot where I'm jumping ahead of myself now, but what you've got is the sweet spot in how a insurance company looks at you as being a risky type of person. So if you've got a policy that runs out tomorrow and you're looking today, they'll see it as being like, they're not organized, they're not methodical, they're more of a risk taker. So when they quote you, they'll quote you a higher figure. If they see it as that you've gone 2 months ago and started doing research on premiums, that you're a diligent person, then they might quote cheaper. Now, what happens is it gets to roughly about 21 days, and that's where the sweet spot is. So what I would say is that, so people will say to you, well, wait before it gets 21 days and then do your quotes then and it'll be cheaper. I don't say that. What I'll tell you to do is about a month and a half. The reason being is that any price that you get on a quote can be locked in for 30 days on a price comparison website. So if you've a month and a half has got the cheapest quote, and then you go back 21 days before it's due, you might find it's gone up in price, where if you've done it a month before, because it's still within that time period of 30 days, it locks it in, you can hold it in at a cheaper quote. If it hasn't, and it's actually cheaper at the 21-day period, can do it then, and you're still within that 30-day period before you actually knew it. So 21 days is about the sweet spot. Looking at excesses is another one. So what I was building up from, which is kind of part of, you know, we'll go into it as part of the recap, but what I was going into from the Cedar side of it is that the information you provide is how an insurance company works out the premium they're going to charge you. So what you want to do is you need to play about this stuff. So if they're asking you a question, that question is relevant. It's got risk attached to it. So what excess do you want in your policy? So what I would do with it is, again, these sweet spots where at some points it won't make any difference, other bits it does. So in general, the lower the excess that you've got, the higher premium that you'll pay. In general, up to a point, the higher the excess, it should have a bearing on your premium where it comes down. But what you want to do is you might find that, say, for example, you've got a £500 excess and it comes down. If you put £1,500 excess on it, it might make a slight difference on it. But if you put £2,000 excess in it, you might think it's going to come down, but it doesn't. So play around with the excess amount, because there's no point paying a higher excess than what you need if it doesn't have a direct bearing on the policy. So the other thing we then went into is that once you've done that, look at insuring the excess separately. Because there's certain providers out there who will insure the excess. So in essence, you're paying two policies. You're paying one for an insurance policy to cover the excess and the other for an insurance policy to cover the vehicle. You might find combined they're significantly lower than what it would have been had you just gone for a lower excess. So that is, you know, that's certainly in the way the cost of living is now, isn't it?
I wouldn't know of anybody that's actually done that. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. I didn't even know that that was even possible.
Yeah. So again, this is the knowledge side of it as well. Because
what's it called? Is there a name for it?
So it's just called an excess policy. So there's a company called Excess Direct, which is one of them. But there's other providers out there that do the same. So if you just Google insurance excess, it should bring up different providers for it. But that is something where if you've got a compulsory and a voluntary excess on your policy, so the compulsory excess you can't get out of. That's what the insurance company is saying. This is what we're going to charge in the event of a claim. And then the voluntary excess is something you're saying, well, I'll agree to pay more money to offset that as a reduced premium. So play about with it. And you'll find at some point that it makes no difference on it. So you could, for example, say, well, I've got a £500 compulsory. For an extra £250, what does it change the policy by? And it might take off a small amount. You might say, well, what difference does it make at £500? Well, it might make a small amount again. But put in an extra £1,000, it might be no different than what it would have been at the £500. So like I said, there's no point paying more money than what you need. Just find out the point when it stops changing it. When you find that, then look at insuring that differently.
Got it.
The thing after that then was to do, so this wasn't in the recap, but do you want me to continue doing the recap? Just catch up and then we'll go in the
Let's bit. Just get there.
So the other thing then was, go straight into it. So the information you're then looking at is that because they're underwriting based on the information, what you've got to understand, and I referred to it before, is that insurance companies haven't changed in an awful amount of time. So dating back to the 1906 Marine Act, the changes in legislation took over 100 years. So within their internal processes, you know, they do change, but they're very slow and reluctant to change. So the specific reason why I'm going this direction is that when you take out a policy and it asks you about your occupation, the wording in that occupation haven't changed for over 50 to 60 years.
Wow.
Now, the loading it has linked to your occupation, the risk attached to that also, it might change slightly, but not an awful lot. So you might find the descriptive terms for somebody's occupation might not directly fit what you do.
Well, especially now.
And as a result of that.
Especially now, because we've seen so many new kind of jobs. I mean, that period of time, we're talking of entire industries that have changed. If you look at the media industry, I mean, you could say, like, previously you were a journalist, but now you could be an influencer or a content creator or you know, a web manager. You know, so many things you could say.
So which of these two things would you think Shad would get charged more for? So Shad's motoring journalist. Yeah, so Shad's a motoring journalist, Shad's a YouTuber, or Shad's a writer. You know, it's like, so if you're a journalist, there's risk attached to that. If you're a motoring journalist, it's different if you've got access to vehicles on it. If you're a YouTuber or an influencer, it could be less. So these descriptive terms have a strong bearing on what you do. If I say I'm a consultant insurance engineer inspecting vehicles, it could be higher. If I say I'm an insurance consultant, it's different. Now, that still accurately represents what I do, because I'm an insurance expert as a consultant. So I'm not misleading them in some way. So like I said, it all comes down to the Consumer Insurance Disclosure Representations Act, and it's about misleading. So if you don't mislead, all you're doing is giving a more accurate description of what you do. Go through the terms on the price comparison website and look at what terms might otherwise describe what you do. The difference in premium are huge. So there could be easily as much as 25 to 50% difference on how an insurance company sees you as risk. That's one of them. The next thing going on from that then is looking at how we work at the moment, and certainly post-COVID, that a lot of people now work from home. The major factor in risk for an insurance company is you commuting to and from a place of work. Now, I found something out the other week, because I'm always playing about with underwriting and how they ascertain risk. And I probably found another. So I surprised you with one last time, and I told you about using Incognito when you're looking at browsing fonts. Yes. That's probably one that nobody else knows about. So I will explain that further in a second. But a second one was, and this one literally just blew my mind, because I'm like, that doesn't make sense. But this is where insurance companies are actually now starting to understand things, and they are getting a grasp of people's working habits. So people now are working more from home than they are from work compared to what they used to do. And as a result of that, it then means that the risk insurance companies have got is lower. But if you still insure your vehicle as to and from a place of work, they're charging you more money, but the actual risk that's there is less because you're not going to work. So they're making more money out of you. So if you're not commuting to work, take it off your policy. Now, the risk you've got of this, again, it comes very, you've got to very carefully listen to what they say. So if they say to you, are you commuting? I would say, no, I'm not. So a commute is a regular occurrence of travel to and from a place, is the way you ascertain it. So I'd say, well, I don't commute. I do go to work, but only occasionally. I don't do it on a regular basis. If they say, do you want cover to and from a place of work? I'd leave it on the policy, because the incident, you say you don't, you, I don't know, I no longer go to an office to work, and then you do, and then you claim, they'll have you, and they're not paying out on it. The bit where it's really interesting, so I use my vehicle for business use, but I work from home. So I don't have somewhere where I commute to in a city centre every day, but I do go to NEC. We saw each other on Saturday. Yeah. You know, part of what I'm saying, you know, it's like I go around and market my services and I do stuff like that. So it's business use. Or I go to other events. So I have class one business use on my policy. Now, the interesting thing is that if you insure yourself for business use, because you might use your vehicle in the process of what you do working for a company, so you don't need to be self-employed or anything like that, or you know, have your own company. You could be an employee of a company. Is that if you insure yourself for first class business use, that still covers you for commuting. But for some reason, it quotes less.
Oh.
So if you just say, I commute, it'll quote you more money. If you insure it for class one business use, I'm not saying this is applicable all of the time, but I was playing about it the other day and I went, oh, that's a bit different. And it didn't make a massive difference on it, but it was less than the actual premium that come back on it. So again, play about on price comparison websites on it. What else have I got for you? So,
you were going to talk about the Incognito thing. I think it's worth mentioning that again.
Yeah, I'll go for that as well. Like I said, I've got a list in front of me. So before we started this, I said to Shad, I've got 20 ones that I need to go through. And Shad said, yeah, but you've only got X amount of time. So excuse me if I'm talking faster than rattling through them, because I want to make sure that all of you get the most value from stuff.
Well, I think people are pretty keen, especially now that you've told them you've got 20.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely as well. So yeah, for the people who noticed that I had a pad of paper last time, the pad of paper I had last time had 10 on it. This one's got 20, so that's why we're writing through them. So yeah, thank you for bringing it to our attention. Yes, we did want to do it, but me and Shad, well, as you can see, I can talk for England, but so can Shad. We're struggling on time. So one of the tips that I gave was that insurance companies track everything. So when you go through a price comparison website or you go on Google and you do your searches for it, when you're in on your browser, it'll want you to save the cookies so it knows that you've been there before. But what happens is, in doing so, is that when you then revisit that website, the insurance companies know you're there, and also the price comparison websites know you're there. Because you're revisiting them, it will quote you a higher premium. So what you want to do is go into an incognito mode on your browser, so it's not tracking the cookies. So anytime you're trying to go through a quote with a different price comparison website or through the ones that you've used, hide your identity on your browser so it doesn't track your IP address, and it will give you a lower quote, I promise you. And that's one that people don't know about. Other things are ways you can save money. So these ones are kind of common sense, what people don't do. And also, this is just to make you low risk. So if you're a young driver, and even if you're not a young driver, do a Pass Plus. So do your Pass Plus test. It will bring up a significant amount of your policy. So you're a young driver, that's a key one. Whether you're a young driver or not, do the Institute of Advanced Motorists test. Become an advanced driver. So some people have got an opinion on it, and they might think pretentious, or they're all fuddy-duddy things. It's like, it's not. They will make you a much better driver. It's part of the foundations of what the police use for their driving. It might change your behaviours and your habits, but as a result of doing that, it'll make you a safer driver. Insurance companies recognise this and they reward it. And it's also a really enjoyable thing to do. I did the issue of advanced drivers like probably 30 years ago. And then I also used to be a driving instructor as well at some point as well. So I've done the Rospers, so bronze, silver and gold. So that's recognised in my premium. So become a better driver. Polish your driving skills. So the better driver you are, the less risk you've got.
So just quickly, do you need to take lessons for that, or do you just apply for the test?
No. So if you're doing the Pass Plus, which you've just passed your driving test, speak to your driving instructor about it. They'll be able to give you more information. But you'll then go through further lessons. So what you do on your Pass Plus test is they'll take you out on motorways, because now you can legally drive them and be tested on them, and look at your positional awareness and how far in front you're looking and what risk you've got. So that'll make you much better. The Institute of Advanced Drivers will probably take you at least 6 weeks to do, if you're doing an hour a week or 2 hours a week. So it's not something if you just go in and do the test on it. You'll need to go through lessons with it and have somebody sat with you. And again, so they'll look at how you drive, your smoothness, your situational awareness, the key things, whether you're reading the road, and then you'll get marked at certain points, and then you can do a final test at the end of it. But the difference on a policy can be anywhere between nothing whatsoever and as much as 15-20%, depending on what age group you are and what issue you've got. So it's definitely worth doing. And look at the time we've got. Part one of the questions we were asked on one of the queries was to do with multi-car policies, and whether it's in your interest to have all of your vehicles on policy. This next bit gets into what I wanted to get into about no-claim bonuses. So insurance companies will tell you that you can only use your no-claim bonus on one policy. If you have a multi-car policy, you've got six cars on that one policy, and you've accrued a no-claim bonus on all of them, what happens if you then take that one car off and go to a different insurance company? Have you accrued a no-claim bonus? So again, looking at CEDRA, the questions they ask you and what information you provide, an insurance company will ask you, have you had any accidents, claims or convictions in the last 3 years or 5 years? And do you have any no-claim bonus? Well, what they do is they always look in the past at what bonus you have, you've accrued, not what you've got in the future. So I appreciate some insurance companies might not be happy about this, but if you've accrued a no-claim bonus, you've accrued a no-claim bonus. So if that's been used across five or six different cars on one policy, then I would say it's fair and reasonable that if you insure that one vehicle somewhere else, you know, if you've accrued 5 years, no claims, it should be applicable. From the ABI, I've not seen anything in any way whatsoever ask the reason why you can't use no claim bonus accrued on one policy somewhere else. I'm not telling you to use a no claim bonus that you're already using from somewhere else. However, I would say that when an insurance company asks, have you accrued no claim bonuses in the past, that that's where they'll look. They won't look at your current policy, they won't look at the past policy. So hopefully you might kind of read between the lines of what I'm saying there. But clearly if you've got full no claim bonus, it will reduce your policy. Looking at where we are with time, cashback sites is another one. So once you find out your best policies, best premiums, you've got your best quote, look at using a price comparison website. See if it's got any links with a cashback site. It might give you some money back. Logical things. When you buy your vehicle, so if you've already got a vehicle, it's a bit different because you've stuck with it and you've got to insure it. But if you're at the point where you're buying a vehicle, for example, if you've got a Porsche Macan, that vehicle comes with lots of different engine sizes. Those engine sizes have a bearing on risk. So if you just purely want a car for the sake of having that car, buy the one with the lowest insurance group rating. Buy the one that's the least powerful out of all of them, if it's just you want to have that prestige of driving that car, rather than driving something for, you know, for its speed. Because an insurance company will factor that in your group rating, and that can make a significant change again. Even on common vehicles, you know, you've got, if you're a young driver and you're looking at a vehicle with a Group 1 rating or up to a Group 10, incrementally, the bearing on the policy is quite small from like Group 1 to Group 5. Once you start getting past Group 10 to Group 20, incrementally, it'll go up by a larger factor. And then from Group 20 to Group 30 and Group 30 to Group 40, each time it goes incrementally bigger and bigger as well. So do your research. If you're looking to get a specific car that might share its platform with different manufacturers, a good example would be a Fiat 500, a Ford Ka, and an Alfa Romeo Mito. The Alfa Romeo Mito has a higher group rating than the Fiat 500, and the Fiat 500 has a larger group rating than the Ford Ka. The reason being is that when an insurance company looks at the group rating on the vehicle, it looks at frontal impacts and what the cost of repair is. And the Alfa Romeo Mito costs more to repair than the Fiat 500, and also the Fiat 500 costs more to repair than the Ford Ka. So when you're looking at a vehicle that you want, again, look at the group rating, because it's quite a strong correlation to the premium you're paying. And also, if you've got time, so I've got these are the last two.
Let's go.
So we're doing quite a long time here. If you've got the time, and again, so there's nothing wrong or fraudulent in any way of this. So this is a means of consumers flipping the coin on insurance companies, because insurance companies want to know everything about you. They hate telling you about them. They will not tell you how they underwrite a policy. They won't tell you anything to do with risk factors. And that really is quite, in my opinion, it's quite duplicitous. It's quite shady, because it's all smoke and mirrors. You know, they've got all the cards and you've not. So flick it back on them. Create an email address that isn't yours. Because then that way, when you're logging into a site, it's an email address that doesn't relate to anything in any way, because it's just something you've created. So it can be anything you want. Use a name that isn't yours. So Joe Blogs. And then what you then want to do is, using incognito mode and using that email address, go on these different price comparison websites, or even directly with insurance companies, and play about with the different factors of how they underwrite the policy. So your occupation, the vehicle, the mileage, your usage to and from a place of work, and try and work out what difference it has on them. Once you can work out how they're trying to underwrite the policy, because you'll see mileage can make a big difference. So again, if you're not commuting to and from a place of work, your mileage might be significantly lower. So you might be able to halve the mileage. But if you halve the mileage that you declare to them, but it doesn't make your policy any cheaper, it serves no purpose. All it does is give the insurance company an opportunity not to pay out. So don't undercut your mileage. It's actually better to tell them you carry out, you know, you travel more miles and less, but play about with it. But unless you can work out how they operate, you'll never know. So if you've got the time, that's a good one. And then the last one, so we've gone through 20 points today, so hopefully people who actually saw the previous YouTube, I didn't say you can go through all these different things. We've gone through 20 points in two pages, we have, promised.
Amazing.
I promise you that we have. So this is it's probably the most significant out of all of them. So certainly bearing in mind the cost of living at the moment and people lacking in finances, I don't necessarily think it's fair how insurance companies operate on this side of it, because it penalises those who can least afford it. But if you're paying for a policy monthly, then the interest rate they will apply can be a lot more than what it would be either through a interest-free credit card or through by getting a loan from the bank. So as an example, to make it easy, if you've got a policy that's £1,000 a year, there's a lot of insurance companies out there that are charging 14% for that 12-month period. So purely based on that, that could be an additional £140 a year. If you went to a bank and got a bank loan out for £1,000, then you'll find the interest rate now is probably about 6.5% to 7%. So you could be paying £70 interest over a year rather than 140.
Wow.
So that's quite a significant saving. Yeah. And obviously, if you're a young driver and you're paying a £3,000 policy, you know, this is a huge difference. So parents, if you've got young kids and you're trying to, you know, you're concerned about the cost of the policies because it's £2,000 or £3,000, don't necessarily look at paying for it monthly with the insurance provider. Look at the interest rates applicable with that insurance company and can you get cheaper, more affordable finance? Now, again, I'm not an advocate of credit cards, but it can also be a good way of actually improving your credit rating. Again, look at which finance is available with which credit card provider on the lowest interest rates, because there's some out there that will give you interest-free credit. So if you've got a £3,000 premium and it's interest-free, compared to paying 14%, you probably saved yourself £400.
No,
makes sense. So look at how you finance a policy. That's the most significant saving out of all of it. And yeah, I mean, I'd always recommend paying your policy off in one go. So I never take it out on credit terms. I always pay for it in one go because I'm in a fortunate situation. I can afford to do so. But if you're not, pay for it in one go with the insurance company, but finance it in a different way. And that is your top 20.
So, listen,
feel free to ask me anything you want.
Absolutely amazing. Absolutely awesome. And hopefully nobody will have any cause for complaint this time. But I'm just going to take another 5 minutes of your time. You talked there about younger drivers, and obviously they get much higher insurance premiums, right? So obviously a new driver, a younger driver, will look for the cheapest car that they can insure. Now, at what age levels can they then think about upgrading their car, assuming they haven't had any accidents or any issues, you know, how does it work? I mean, I think, is it still like when you get to 21, it proves, is that still the case? Or?
Yeah. So the fact is that there's lots of weird things. So if you do your Pass Plus and you do your Institute of Advanced Driving at 17, in essence, it's going to leapfrog you in front of somebody who's 23.
Oh, wow.
So if you don't do those things and you get to the age of 23, that's at the point when it starts becoming affordable. Right. If you do the Pass Plus and the IAM, it's going to leapfrog you in front of other people because you'll be seen as being a more conscientious person because you thought, I need to be a better driver. I'm not sure I've passed my test and I've gone off and done it. Insurance companies hate that because the major risk for insurance companies, the reason why premiums are so, what you need to do is look at the reason why premiums are so high for young kids. Well, this is also when it's the risk of not just the driver, it's the risk of people being inside the car and having a crash. And statistically, from the age of 17 to 20 odd, they're the highest risk group of any age group. They're probably about 75 to 80% more likely to have an accident than people outside of that age group. So that's where the highest risk is. If you show that you're conscientious, by doing those tests, it'll reduce it significantly.
Just sticking with that for a minute. I'm looking at the channel, it's Brown Car Guy. We're assuming that there are young people maybe looking at the channel that are just about to pass their test, whatever, and they want to get into something sporty. So would you advise them to start with something basic and then wait until you get to 21, 23 before you get something sporty?
Yeah. Categorically, do not buy something sporty because you'll probably kill yourself. You might think you're the best driver on earth. You're not. So if I can make it any more blunt, at the age of 17, so unless you've got experience in motorsport, you've done karting or something like that, from the age of 17 to at least well into your 20s, if you pass your test at 17, even at the age of 24 or 25, you're a crap driver. You're nowhere near as good as what you think you are, and you will outdrive yourself. The issue you've also got is, again, this goes back to what I do as a job. So I do accident investigation, and what I look at what people do to have accidents and what causes it. And the things that we have now compared to what we had when we were kids is that we were driving on cars that had very small tyres. So, for example, a Vauxhall Viva had 155 tyres on it, so tiny. The other 28 Capri, Brooklands Capri, it had 205 6013 tyres on it, and we thought they were wide. Yeah. Now, what you've got then is that you've got Vauxhall Corsas and, cars of that type, and they're on 235 section tyres. So what you have is these cars have got loads of mechanical grip, which then means that people think they can, they think they're brilliant drivers because the car's grip. But the problem you've then got is that, and it's also kind of dependent on weather conditions, because the wider tyre you've got, the worse it is in the wet. So that's always a risk. But these tyres, when they start breaking away, once you get to that point of maximum adhesion, that'll just let go. But the problem you've got is that you're going that fast then because of the pure amounts of mechanical grip. You're not doing what we were doing at our age, at 20, 30 mile an hour, 40 mile an hour. You're doing 80 and 90. And the likelihood is you would die. Well, the other side of it is that if you've got three of your friends in the car and you crash it at 90 miles an hour, they die as well. Insurance companies know that. So this is the reason why they want to apply curfews on you or restrict the amount of people you've got in the vehicle. So by being something like an advanced driver, an insurance company will go, the thought about this, they want to be better than what they are. They're probably a lot less of a risk taker because they're conscientious.
Yeah, that makes
a significant difference.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Having a vehicle.
This is you've gone into an area that's like an entirely different podcast about driving and stuff. But I so relate to what you're saying. And just if I'm going to sidetrack for a second here, it's one of the reasons that the current Nissan GTR R35 is hugely awesome and hugely impressive, but not one of my favorite cars, because it's one of those cars that will literally grip, and then it will let go big time. That's what will happen. And you'll just be a smear on the side of a cliff somewhere. That's what will happen.
A quick one for you then. So we said about sports cars, there are anomalies within this factoring ratio. So look at a Mark 1 or a Mark 2 Mazda MX-5. Because if you're a young kid, so you might say it has been a sports car, but it's still quite low powered. Because you can only carry one passenger, it's the passenger that's the risk. If you've got a Ford KA and you've got three kids in the back and one in the front, for every one of them that you might kill in an accident, it could be £50 million or £20 million. So
that's amazing.
The amount of passengers
has a direct... buy that little two-door roadster.
Yeah. Wow. So it has a direct correlation to risk.
Okay, so just quickly, a couple more things. Parking. Does that really make a, when they ask you where you park in the car, does that make a huge difference? Some people live in apartments like I do. I mean, I don't park on the road, but I park in residential. I mean, how much difference does that make?
Huge from a theft point of view. So depending on the vehicles, because some cars are theft risk and other ones aren't as much. I would advise, so if you live in a city centre, so the highest risk places in the UK are London, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, not necessarily in that order, but so anywhere where there's a city, Leeds as well is another one. If you live near a city, the chances are your car's going to get nicked, and even more so if it's desirable. So make your car less desirable. Make it so that they might go off and nick somebody else's, but at least it's not yours. So what I would say is the steering wheel lock that encompasses your steering wheels is a wheel lock. They're not pretty, but they're extremely effective. So my background is, like I said, an engineer, used to be a mechanic. I've tried to get one of these off when the keys have been lost for it. And with an angle grinder, it took me about 3 hours. They're an absolute nightmare. So it's not something. So even though you can get battery powered angle grinders now, it ain't going to last 3 hours. So if you've got a steering wheel locked around your car, a thief is going to walk past it. So, and certainly anybody with a Range Rover, buy one now. There's a lot of insurance companies now won't even insure them.
Let's get into that another time. So just quickly, just finishing off on this, because we are really running out the clock today, and I hope that people will enjoy this podcast. But again, just sticking with that, the anti-theft aspect of it, because I remember when I was younger, I had to several times get immobilizers installed on cars back then. I mean, I think now they're standard, but I had to do that, and that would make a significant difference to my policy at the time.
So these things where is a again, Range Rovers are a good example for it, but BMWs as well. Look at Ghost immobilizers. But the issue you got with that is that they'll still break into it to get it. So having something that you can see. So the steering wheel locks, which is like a bar that runs through your steering wheels, don't get them because they're crap. Because all you need to do is hacksaw through the steering wheel, you can pull them off. But the full wheel lock, cracking. The other one is also things like pedal locks. So anybody who's got a Land Rover will be aware of it, but you can get a lock that covers all three pedals, clamps down to the floor of your car, or through the steering wheel, and it'll stop your car from getting stolen. So don't put any of your personal possessions on view. So things like if you've been shopping, make sure it's covered up in the hatch at the back of it. Don't leave things on your seats. Don't give people an opportunity to think, I want to look in your car or break into it. So that's the side of it. But yeah, your vehicle's a lot less likely to get nicked if it's on your drive compared to being on the road, and even more so if it's in your garage.
Yeah.
So if you've got a garage, that can make a difference on it. However, in my personal situation, I tell my insurance company that my car is stored on my drive, even though I have a garage and it's always garaged. It's virtually never left out on the drive. Now, the reason why I do that is that in the event that one day when I go somewhere and leave it parked on the drive overnight and it gets nicked and they go, well, you told it was garage and it wasn't, we're not paying out. I want that never to occur. So again, going back to what I said at the start of it, never ever give an insurance company any opportunity in any way whatsoever not to pay out.
This is perfect.
Because they will.
We've come full circle. This is perfect. We've come full circle.
Cool.
And we've gone nearly 60 minutes.
Well, think about... Yeah, so if you think about what I do, so the name of my company is called Motor Claim Guru. So I help people with claims. So the reason why I have this information is the people who come to me are people who might have had an insurance company saying it's not paid out on the policy. So why have they not paid out on the policy? And this is what I investigate in what I'm doing. So I find out why insurance companies not paid out, and then I make them pay out because I'll find out whether you have intentionally done something to deceive them. And if you haven't, there's legislation in place and regulations in place that they have to adhere to. So as long as you've not been negligent, you've not done something willfully and intentionally to deceive them for the benefit of financial gain, if it's something where it's an innocent error, they have to pay. Now, they will argue that, no, you've not declared it, or you've done something, or, you know, an example could be that if, say, you've got a tracker on your vehicle, but it's not activated. So one of the common ones I've come across recently, because I deal with loads and loads of Land Rovers, loads and loads of Range Rovers. I'm not a fan of the brand whatsoever. I hate them. But part of what was happening was that Range Rovers were being sold and being sold as saying that they have a tracker fitted to them. Well, there's a big difference between having a tracker fitted to them and a tracker that's active. And what the salespeople weren't telling consumers was that you had to go on to Land Rover's website and activate the tracker to make sure it's on when you've bought the vehicle. So I had people buying brand new Land Rovers at £100,000 or £120,000 from the dealer, believing it had an active tracker because you would expect Land Rover to activate it for you, but they hadn't. Insuring the vehicle and being asked at that point of inception, does the vehicle have an active tracker? Well, I say it doesn't. Bought it brand new. It's got a tracker within the purchase price of it. It then gets stolen in London and the tracker's not active. Then the insurance company saying we're not paying out. So I've currently got three of them on the go. And you know, it's like £100,000 a time. And the insurance companies are saying we're not paying out because we know they're a theft risk. You should have put, you know, it should have had an active tracker. You know, the person's
the
going,
thing is,
well, it did.
What is becoming very clear is that even though we've run out the clock today and we're going to end this now, but I think we might have to have a part three. I reckon we probably have to have a part three to this. So everybody stand by. Let us know what you think in the comments. We'd love to hear your comments. We'd love to hear your feedback. And Tim, thanks so much for doing this today. And I think if you're amenable, we might do it again soon. Say next month.
Absolutely. I can do a third or a fourth, but it's as you're aware when you start talking to me, and like I said at the NEC, it's like popping a balloon because, you know, I love what I'm doing, enthusiastic about it. But I want consumers to be educated because at the moment we have this, there's no parity between insurance companies or financial industries and consumers because everything's weighed in their favour. So what I want to do is educate the general public to make sure that we can readdress this balance, to make sure it's fairer, to make sure that when you are getting a policy, you're getting what you're entitled to, but also that you're not paying more than what you need to for something. Because the problem you've got with car insurance is that you have to have it. It's mandatory. It's not something you can just go, well, I won't get it because I don't really need it. It's a forced sale that's on you that you can't get out of. So understanding how to make the best out of the money that you're spending with your policy, to me, is a key thing. But I said, the other side of it is that you need to look at why do you buy that policy, what you want it to do. So if you're not bothered about getting your own car repaired, check out if the third-party fine theft policy is cheaper. If you've got an expensive vehicle, you want to make sure it's repaired, make sure there's no restrictions on the policy that you're buying that stops you from, for example, you might have a BMW and you want it to go to a BMW-approved repairer or a Porsche it could be any car. Make sure there's no restrictions on the policy that stop you from your legal right of choice of who repairs a car. So I want to make sure that the people are informed and understand their rights on it. So, as much as I can do to help the people, contact Shad. If you'd like a third video, give us a shout. I'm more than up for it. Yeah. And Shad's going to put some links my website and what I'm doing.
If you want to see more of Tim and his amazing font of wisdom, knowledge and experience, then let us know. And we'll get back on this and maybe we'll do one again next month.
And
thank you so much.
Remember the last thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Before you stop, I remember the last thing. Look, the shell's fixed.
Yes.
So it's not sagging. So the people kept saying to me, will it last? And also, for anybody who commented on it, it's actually, there's a visual illusion on there as well. The shelf's curved as well. So it looks bent, but it's not. So if you look at that shadow, you can see it's not a straight line. So yeah, you were half right. But I have put a new roll plug in it and it now supports the weight. So thank you to all of you kept pointing out.
Thanks to everybody that was really concerned about that last time. But awesome. Thanks so much, Tim. And I'll catch you again soon.
Thank you, gang. Lovely to see you. A brown car guy.
Hope you enjoyed that video. If you did, please, please hit the like button and share this video as well if you can. And while you're at it, check out these guys who also sponsor my content. I am deeply grateful to them because it helps me to buy new equipment, put fuel in the cars, and yes, buy a cup of coffee. You can do the same. Just go here or right here on YouTube. Just hit these three little dots down here and click on thanks. Make sure you're signed in first. My content is free. But this is how you can help me keep it that way. I may even send you a gift. Oh, by the way, watch this next.